Hello, and welcome to COVIDcast, a weekly Low Institute podcast for anyone interested in understanding the effects of the coronavirus on the world and international life. My name is Roland Raja, and I'm Director of the International Economy Program at the Lowy Institute in Sydney, Australia. As this crisis unfolds, we're sitting down every week with experts from a range of fields to discuss the implications of coronavirus for the world. You'll find all the previous episodes on the homepage of our website. In this episode, we'll be talking about the historic collapse in global oil prices and what this means for the world economy, as well as the economics and geopolitics of the Middle East. I'll be speaking with Rachel Ziemba, who is an adjunct senior fellow at the Center for a New American Security, where she focuses on the interlinkages between economics, finance, and security issues. Rachel also serves as a strategic advisor at an equity futures fund and is the founder of Ziemba Insights, a macroeconomic research firm. We'll also be joined by the Lowy Institute's Roger Shanahan, who many listeners will already know is the Institute's expert on the Middle East and security issues. To begin with, it's useful to recap briefly on what's been going on. Last week, we saw the price for oil for delivery in May briefly turning negative, meaning that if you happen to have had a barrel of oil, you actually would have had to pay someone to take it off your hands. Since then, prices have moved out of negative territory, but still remain extremely low. And behind this, of course, has been the historic collapse in global demand due to the coronavirus and the lockdowns and social distancing restrictions that have been put in place in response. But it's also about a lot more than this, also reflecting a relative glut in world oil supply, a breakdown in coordination among major oil producers, and technical factors in the oil market that allowed the price of oil to actually turn negative. So turning to Rachel first, can you kick us off by explaining in a little more detail some of the mechanics of what's been happening in oil markets and perhaps, you know, how you see this playing out over the short to medium term?
Thanks, Roland, and pleasure to be with you guys today and talk about this issue. So what happened last week, I think, has reinforced what's been a real demand collapse due to COVID-19. And it's really a function that the global economy, and especially the U.S. economy, is running out of storage. We have the U.S. Gulf Coast isn't fully out of storage. We're a couple weeks away from that happening. And so what happened was, even though there was a little capacity, that was already pre-leased. So for a couple of hours there, there were no buyers. So if we look past this historic event, what's going to happen over the next couple of weeks, I think, will continue to be driven by this demand challenges. If anything, there's still so much oil present. Saudi Arabia is sending many, many shipments still to the United States, despite having agreed to cut production. And if anything, U.S. production has been slow to come offline. And even though parts of the U.S. economy, some other economies, are starting to reopen after their COVID shutdowns, that is not going to get people out there driving and using a lot of oil. So I think this demand story is going to be the driving force. So we might not touch negative prices again, but this is going to be a painful story for oil producers.
Yeah, I mean, that sort of raises an important sort of threshold question, you know, because of course it is bad for the oil producers. But of course, on the other hand, it's also, you know, low oil prices are also good for consumers and it's good for the net importing countries, many of are in Asia. So in a sense, it's, you know, it's also a good thing. So I'm sort of interested in you know, how should we think about this in terms of the net impact for the global economy? And then an additional complication, I suppose, is what the impact this will have on inflation. So in the short term, this is, of course, a massive disinflationary effect, deflationary effect. So that might raise some concerns, given deflation is the last thing we need right now. It would really worsen debt dynamics at exactly the wrong time. But conversely, once we perhaps get to the other side of the crisis, you know, if oil supplies are becoming more restricted, if a lot of supply has gone offline, is there a risk that when we start trying to get the economy going again, if we start trying to use stimulus, that it might cause a spike in inflation? So I guess my question is, you know, Rachel, how do you think about this in terms of, is this a net good thing or a net bad thing for the global economy?
So I tend to think of it as a net bad thing for the global economy. You're completely right that typically an oil price decline is good for consumers, not only consuming nations, places like India, places like South Korea, China, and even countries like Turkey. The problem is this is coming at the same time as a major demand. So I think the question is, what is global demand for a range of products look like? as we come out of the COVID crisis? How much damage has there been to balance sheets? And of course, we have a hit to the import demand from oil-producing countries and places like Saudi Arabia that import a lot, including from Asian countries. So I tend to think of it as globally a bit of a net negative. On the inflation side, of course, we're technically going to have inflation. Oil prices are not going to stay at $15 a barrel or negative for a long period of time. But when I think about the whole global economy, it's an issue of, is this going to pass through to other prices? And I think for that to happen, we need to start seeing wage growth. And we need to start seeing credit growth and maybe that chasing the same amount of goods. Looking particularly at the U.S. economy, we have almost 30 million people unemployed, and the number is rising. I don't think that labor is going to have wage-setting powers. And retailers and wholesalers are having trouble passing on higher costs to the end user. So my verdict is still comes down to deflation being a risk, more so than inflation. And I feel if anything, central banks, especially in the emerging world, are so worried about inflation that they, if anything, will start to tighten up. Places like, to some extent, Indonesia, but especially places like Brazil and elsewhere. So I feel like it would be an easier problem to solve than deflation.
Yeah, I think I agree with that. I mean, it's hard to be worried about inflation in the current environment. And certainly, I think even once we're out the other side of the depth of the current crisis, there'll still be a situation of depressed global demand anyway. And so how much oil prices can pass through to higher inflation, I think, is something is questionable. But it is interesting. And as you note, many policymakers are and many political commentators are very, very concerned always about the risk of inflation. And that can be a, you know, it can deter necessary stimulus as well. So I think it's definitely an interesting question. But let's take the conversation back to the producer countries, because there's a lot of interesting things going on here. Before we get Roger to come in, maybe it'd be useful, Rachel, if you could give us a bit of a, you know, an initial overview of how you see this affecting the various oil-producing nations out there. I mean, who is going to be hit really hard and who might be able to weather this reasonably well?
Good question. So, of course, the outlook is dreadful for all producers, corporate companies, but also sovereigns that rely on the dynamics. On the corporate side and amongst developed economies, it's actually countries whose output is higher on the cost curve. So places like Canada, where I come from, are really going to suffer on that regard. At the sovereign level, the most vulnerable countries are the places that are very reliant on oil revenues and who were already struggling to balance their books when oil prices were $70 a barrel and they were producing more. And across the board, everyone's balance sheets look weaker than they did in 2008 and in 2014, in part because of stimulus done at that point. So the most resilient countries are richer countries like Qatar, Kuwait, the UAE, and Russia, all of which have more fiscal space or past savings, sovereign funds that can support and help bridge this transition. The weakest ones are countries like Nigeria, Algeria, Angola, Iraq, and Oman and Bahrain, and sanctioned countries like Iran and Venezuela that are under such stress. In the middle are countries like Kazakhstan and Saudi Arabia that have savings, but also have very meaningful spending needs today. Another broad dynamic across the region and globally is that even some of the richer countries are likely to invest less money via their sovereign funds in the region, but also as they face unemployment, there will be less remittances sent. That's going to affect countries like Egypt, countries in South Asia, and will generally be a hit to consumption across the world. And for all of these countries, their question is, do they cut spending that hurts political stability, likely? Do they sell assets, maybe at a loss? Or do they borrow? And so some of them will be able to borrow, but I think that just widens the gap within and between countries.
That's interesting. Roger, listening to all of this, I mean, what do you see as the major and sort of immediate political, geopolitical, and security consequences of what's happened in the oil price for the countries in the Middle East?
Yeah, thanks, Roland. I'd probably say two things. First of all, if we look at Saudi Arabia and there's that issue about was this the situation they find themselves in a result of external factors or was it the result of political decision-making? And certainly the COVID-19 crisis was foisted upon everybody, so the collapse in oil prices was happening. But we also have to take a look at the oil price war that was initiated in the first week of March. And although we don't know the exact role of the Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, you know, reports are that he was instrumental in launching an oil price war that was aimed initially against Russia for not towing the line in reducing oil exports. But it's essentially blown up in his face in terms of the timing, because not only did we have this drop in demand that could have and should have been foreseen, but he exacerbated it by trying to punish Russia by producing even more oil in a market that was already awash in the stuff. Now, that has obvious implications for Saudi Arabia, as Rachel pointed out, and from what we understand, there'll be budgetary cuts, but they're obviously not going to cut into salaries for the public sector employees for obvious reasons. But what it does mean is domestic Vision 2030, the plan for the modernization of Saudi Arabia and a move away as far as possible from such reliance on oil as part of the economy, that's really going to be put on the back burner, you would think. But I think the greater problem is just additional reputational damage for Mohammed bin Salman because of his poor decision-making. We've seen this as a kind of constant pattern where he takes a tactical decision without regard to the second-order effects of that decision that he's making. And that reduces the confidence in him in the future in key capitals. Now, in Washington, it hasn't been that much of a problem at the moment because he has such a close relationship with the Trump administration, which is really all about the economy, doesn't really care about many other foreign policy drivers. And he has this very, very close relationship with Jared Kushner, a personal relationship, which is all well and good so long as that administration stays in power. But the Democrats, as we saw through the presidential primaries, they are not so complimentary of the Saudi leadership. And we saw as a result of that oil price war that four or five US senators wrote an open letter in which they accused not only Russia but Saudi Arabia of waging economic war against the United States, which is quite strong language. So there is an obvious reputational blow to Mohammed bin Salman. There would be a sense in Saudi Arabia that come November, if there's a change of government, perhaps the relationship with Washington is going to reflect the relationship with the Crown Prince, and that might not be a good thing. It was quite notable that on the 7th of March, around the same time that this oil price war was instigated, that two potential rivals for leadership, Prince Ahmed and Mohammed bin Nayef, were detained by the Crown Prince. So the Crown Prince is alert to the fact that his position is not set in concrete, and he, as we've seen in the past, wants to sideline potential rivals. Now, you could see sometime in the future that Washington will always want to maintain close relations with Riyadh, but it doesn't necessarily have to involve a Riyadh under a King MBS as opposed to Crown Prince MBS. So I think it's just at the political level in terms of bilateral relations, this is just another black mark against Mohammed bin Salman's decision-making, and that may have consequences in the future about his accession to power. And probably just very quickly, more broadly, and I think we'll probably get into this a bit more, I completely agree with what Rachel said about the ability of the small Gulf states to ride this out. You know, Qatar and the UAE, small populations, very large reserves, they can ride this out in a variety of manners. And those countries that find it more difficult to ride out, particularly Bahrain, will always be bailed out by Saudi Arabia. So again, it just means that their relationship with Riyadh is, colloquially speaking, more subservient than it probably is at the moment. It will become that way, but they're not going to collapse anytime soon. The bigger consequences are going to be in Iran and Iraq, and Iraq in particular, because of its over-reliance on not only oil, which makes up around two-thirds of its GDP, but also oil fuels the public sector wages, which in turn guarantees government stability. And we've seen in the past people getting out on the streets criticizing government corruption. This is just going to exacerbate that problem.
Yeah, very interesting. I mean, interesting that Saudi Arabia can underwrite a lot of the stability in the region in some ways, but is also, as you say, a source of instability. I mean, one thing you touched on there, Roger, we're trying to get Rachel in on, is, of course, how America's role in all of this has changed very dramatically over the past decade as a result of the shale oil revolution. So, you know, where is U.S. shale industry headed now, given the current environment, Rachel, and, you know, with the oil prices coming down, but also, as Roger mentioned, you know, a lot of what's driven this from the Saudi and Russian perspective has also been about the fight with U.S. shale.
Completely. One of the things that really led to the misjudgment in early March was this view that high-cost producers, including shale and unconventional supplies in Canada, had to adjust, that the Saudis and Russians were not willing to bear that cost. So I think what we'll see is a nimbler, more consolidated, obviously lower producing shale industry in the U.S. I don't think the Saudis and Russians will succeed in crushing it as they hope. I mean, in fact, you've had a half decade of these countries trying to crush the shale industry. I tend to think that in the U.S., it's somewhat easier for the oil sector to squeeze their whole supply chain, to squeeze the oil service companies and the like. And there are actually some big oil companies like Exxon who are sitting on cash and didn't really get into shale plays. So while we will see a production decline, I wouldn't count the U.S. shale industry out. I would underscore Roger's point about this growing distrust about Saudi Arabia and note that this might be becoming more bipartisan. We have seen President Trump talk about tariffs on Saudi and Russian oil. I don't think that's a base case scenario, and I don't think it would help very much. But this is a U.S. administration that has been very willing to impose tariffs and other restrictions across the line. Looking ahead to the next administration, if the government does change, I think we'll see also a greater push on the environmental side and renewable energy side. So more generally, I don't see this really shifting what has been a U.S. Effort to get out of some entanglements in the Middle East. But I also see it them continuing to double down on their sanctions regimes under this administration, particularly in Iran, but also in Venezuela. We have seen a reluctance to create some humanitarian exemptions and to respond to some of the health crisis needs. And I don't see that that changing.
Yeah. So we've just talked about the United States. And of course, we need to also talk about the obligatory China question. What's the role of China, you know, in all of this? Could it be a lifeline? What's the status of the relationship? I mean, Roger, if I ask you to sort of weigh in first, where does China fit into the equation in your view?
Probably most significant element at the moment is China's relationship with Iran. You know, China has been a lifeline for Iranian oil exports, and there are reports that in terms of storage, Iranian oil has been stored in Chinese storage facilities. And I think this will just continue to reinforce that economic relationship between China and Iran, because in reality, Iran has few other alternatives. It would probably much rather have a much broader set of customers for obvious reasons, but it has limited options. So I think what we're going to see as a result of this is just an even stronger bilateral economic relationship between China and Iran.
And Rachel, I'll give the last comment to you on this.
Sure. So I think more generally, China obviously has an interest in securing its energy supplies, but I think it's going to be focused on maintaining diversity of oil supplies. It doesn't want to be only tied into the Iranian basket. More generally, I think we've seen Chinese policy response across the board as being more muted and modest than in past crises. And the energy sector is among that. So I don't see China really running to the rescue. Neither do I see countries like India playing that role. So I think there's going to be real challenges and a workout on some of the distressed assets that are coming through the pipeline.
Okay, that's very interesting, Rachel. Unfortunately, that is all we have time for, though we could obviously keep talking for a long time. But let me just thank Rachel and Roger for joining me today for the discussion, as well as acknowledge my Low Institute colleagues, Sandra Rigby and Jennifer Reinhart, for production assistance. COVIDcast is a limited edition weekly podcast from the Low Institute for anyone interested in the impact of the coronavirus on the world and international life. Please keep an eye on our social media channels for details of the next episode of COVIDcast, and you can stay up to date with all the latest developments on the coronavirus via the Low Institute's widely read digital magazine, The Interpreter. Thank you all for listening today, and we'll catch up with you again next week.